From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. And I begin the new year with bad news. No, not unpleasant news. You can get that anywhere. I'm saying bad news. News delivered badly, plus the corrections or apologies that followed. Yes, in a bittersweet annual ritual, we are joined once again by Pointer's Craig Silverman, author of the Regret the Error blog, for a roundup of the worst media mistakes of the past 12 months. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
There was a correction in November from the Patriot News of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which was notable for two things, actually being more of an amplification than a correction, and also for being exactly 150 years late.
The Patriot News is famous for being a paper that actually panned the Gettysburg Address when it first was delivered. And they figured that, well, with the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address coming up, maybe it's time for us to really address what happened. They published a correction, and it reads, "In the editorial about President Abraham Lincoln's speech delivered November 19, 1863 in Gettysburg, the Patriot and Union failed to recognize its momentous importance, timeless eloquence, and lasting significance. The Patriot News regrets the error."
The retraction so amused the people at Saturday Night Live that they devoted a segment of a weekend update to the supposed author of the original review. It sounded like this.
How do you feel about the newspaper's retraction?
I stand by my words. They're cowards, Seth. In fact, my first draft was much harsher, and I was told to tone it down. Would you like to hear it?
Sure.
4 snores and 7 yawns ago, this reviewer watched the president's speech at Gettysburg, and let's be honest, Abe, you dropped a real Lincoln log.
The putative author of the original editorial, Jebediah. If we have learned anything in the internet age, it is pretty easy to make stuff up, tweet it out, or put it on Facebook, or put it in a blog, and just watch mainstream media uncritically repeat the hoax. Some examples, please.
One report that circulated a little bit was that New York Times columnist and economist Paul Krugman had declared personal bankruptcy.
Nobel Prize winning economist Paul Krugman.
Yes. There was a report that President Obama was reaching into his personal finances to fund a Muslim museum. There were reports that Mike Tyson got a sex change. And one of the ones that was, you know, really widely reported and that nobody questioned and that was really turned into a big story was, of course, in relation to former Notre Dame linebacker Manti Te'o.
He was the subject of a Deadspin piece which tried to track down the girlfriend who had inspired him and tragically died during his great Notre Dame season. And what Deadspin found out was
she didn't exist. Deadspin dedicated the resources to look at this and to realize that a lot of the dates and a lot of the things that were described didn't match up. It was a very good piece of investigative reporting, and it was also an excellent bit of debunking, which I hope we see a lot more from news organizations, because in truth, you can get a lot of traffic from debunking the hoax rather than being the one that plays along with it.
And for that accomplishment, Deadspin was awarded the coveted Best Debunking Prize from Regret the Error. And congratulations to them. Craig, there was a story following the Asiana Air tragedy in July that it's just simply phenomenal to me. For starters, let's just play the tape.
KTDU has just learned the names of the 4 pilots who were on board the flight. They are Captain Sum Ting Wong, Wee Tu Lo, Ho Li Fook, and Bang Ding Ao. The NTSB has confirmed these are the names of the pilots on board Flight 214 when it crashed.
The information did come from a credible source, which is the National Transportation Safety Board. So there was somebody who was working there who decided to play a little bit of a joke. And this information that they had written up as a joke ended up making its way to this TV station. And of course, they want to be ones to get this information out right away. They're a local TV station. I think it's a really good example of even when you have it from a very credible source, you should still be asking yourself, is this accurate? Is this credible? And are there any other places that I can go to corroborate what I'm getting from them?
Okay, now before we get to the most esteemed error of the year, let's talk about the runner-up. It's a very serious matter. It is the page one cover of the New York Post, I think 48 hours after the Boston bombing, with the gigantic screaming headline, Bag Men.
This is a cover that I think probably lives in infamy at this point. It shows two young men standing in the area of the marathon with bags. And everyone knew at that point that the bombs had been contained in bags. And so to show these two young men carrying bags, to label them bag men, to note that this was related to the bombings, and to note that authorities were looking to speak to them, was really enough to paint them as, if not suspects, frankly, guilty. And as a result of this cover, the two men have sued the Post. It was really an incredibly egregious error. And on top of that, the Post has actually never really apologized for it.
When I saw that play out, I said to myself, that there is Craig Silverman's error of the year. But no, it was merely the runner-up. What could possibly have out-errored Bagman?
I would agree with you that when I saw it, I thought that's probably going to be the one. But then 60 Minutes aired the Benghazi report.
This is Lara Logan's story impeaching the Obama administration's description of events in the raid on the diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya.
At the core of the story is a source named Dylan Davies, who worked in security at the compound. He was saying, listen, contrary to what I had said previously, contrary to what I had told my employer, I actually did go to the compound that night, and I saw things.
He started walking towards me.
And as he was coming closer?
As I got closer, I just hit him with the butt of the rifle in the face.
And?
Oh, he went down, yeah. Like a stone.
So he made some very explosive claims, and a lot of the story hung on what he had said.
But it turns out, in fact, that Davies was lying. He had given an entirely different story to the FBI.
That's right. There was a bit of corroborating evidence that 60 Minutes should have and did attempt to get, but they didn't get it. They didn't manage to find out what he had told the FBI. And so they really didn't have one of the critical pieces of verification they needed to go ahead with this. The other piece of this that really looked bad on 60 Minutes is that Davies had a book coming out telling his story. And the book was being published by Simon & Schuster, which is a sister company of CBS News. And so, number one, the piece that aired did not disclose this. And number two, after it was proven that he had been dishonest, the question started to be raised, well, did 60 Minutes not do its usual sort of diligence because they had a book from a sister company?
And number three, the due diligence that somehow eluded CBS was handled by other news organizations within 48 hours of the report airing, and they did find the FBI report and Davies' story and Lara Logan's story unraveled.
Very soon after the 60 Minutes piece aired, the New York Times came out with a report declaring what was in that FBI interview with Davies and saying that it contradicted what he had told 60 Minutes. And when it comes down to it, the idea that 60 Minutes would broadcast this without having had that corroboration of what he told the FBI is really tough to stomach. And that's one of the reasons why I think people have been so harshly critical. The New York Times got this information very quickly.
All right, Craig. Well, thank you so much and Happy New Year.
Thanks. Same to you.
Craig Silverman writes the Regret the Error blog on Poynter.org, where you can find the rest of his annual roundup of the year's big media screw-ups. 60 Minutes' October Benghazi story is the media error of the year, but it wasn't the end of 2013's reporting on Benghazi. In a more than 7,000-word piece last week, New York Times reporter David Kirkpatrick reviewed the 2012 incident to determine whether it was a local affair triggered by an anti-Muslim YouTube video, as the Obama administration first asserted, or, as House Republicans contend, al-Qaeda elements participating in a planned assault on the U.S. compound there on the anniversary of 9/11. In that narrative, the White House covered up the al-Qaeda connection with an eye to the presidential election weeks later. Kirkpatrick spent months with American and Libyan officials, eyewitnesses, and leaders of various Islamic militias. What he found, unsurprisingly, was murk, security and intelligence failures in Libya, radical anti-Americanism, strange and violent bedfellows, but no evidence of an al-Qaeda role, and therefore no administration cover-up. Indeed, Kirkpatrick reported, the violence was fueled in part by a video made by a sketchy Californian Coptic Christian denigrating Islam. But according to Politico's Blake Houndshell, the Times story did nothing to quell the debate
On the contrary, in a partisan environment wherein dogma trumps fact-finding, the Times story was just a bellows for an eternal flame.
The liberal media breathed a sigh of relief and said, you know, thank goodness this is finally over. And the conservative media cried foul and said, this is the liberal media making its case for Hillary Clinton in 2016 and whitewashing what happened in Benghazi. And that was mirrored in the reaction on Capitol Hill as well. The conservative House members just flatly disputed the New York Times account and said it was wrong.
That would include Congressman Daryl Issa, who heads the House Oversight Committee, which has spent the last 14 months looking into Benghazi to prove their contention of an administration cover-up, which, by the way, I think they believed first was to protect President Obama in his reelection campaign. But in any case, he goes on Meet the Press, and what does he have to say?
He contradicted the Times account. He said,
so we have seen no evidence that the video was widely seen in Benghazi, a very isolated area, or that it was the leading cause.
And he said that Al-Qaeda really was behind the attack, and he has, according to him, the evidence to prove it. So he's not giving up, and he can dribble tidbits of information, leak selectively to media outlets that are receptive, and keep this thing alive well into next year.
You have a whole list of reasons that this debate will go on and on. What else is keeping us from clarity on this matter?
The really key thing is this point about what Al-Qaeda is. Is Al-Qaeda a highly centralized, top-down organization that gives orders carried out all over the world? Is it more of a decentralized network of regional groups that have their own local grievances and have different kinds of relationships with the core Al-Qaeda leadership based somewhere in Pakistan? Or is Al-Qaeda really just a brand, a movement that's better described as Sunni jihadism, and these local groups that have grievances, they don't need to take orders from a central organization because they're all marching in the same direction? How you answer that question really informs your definition of this attack in Benghazi.
Blake, as I read the Kirkpatrick piece, I came away with the conclusion that what's the difference whether Al-Qaeda was involved? Militant Islamic jihadist organizations were and are on the ground in Libya. He spoke to many of their leaders and foot soldiers. It's a mess, and whether one of them was more or less Al-Qaeda affiliated sort of seems besides the point. And yet this whole debate centers on an Al-Qaeda connection, and the whole Al-Qaeda connection seems to hinge on a single phone call made by one of the participants in the Benghazi violence to a friend with supposed Al-Qaeda affiliations. Tell me about that phone call.
That phone call was first reported by Eli Lake at the Daily Beast within days of the attack. And the way Eli Lake characterized it was that this was really definitive proof that this was Al-Qaeda, because here you had a participant in the attack phoning someone who he said was in the North African affiliate of Al-Qaeda, bragging about the success. And the takeaway from that piece was this was a planned terrorist attack, and it was Al-Qaeda. That was contradicting the Obama administration's line at the time, so it had a lot of political resonance. Now, the New York Times interpretation of the phone call was that the person on the other line, this guy, sounded surprised in the interpretation of the Times sources. So that's just a matter of how do you hear this phone call? How do you translate the Arabic?
I want to veer away from what did or did not happen in Benghazi that night 14 months ago, and come back to the whole ecosystem that you began to describe as we started this conversation, where interpretations of events are informed not by evidence or facts, but worldview. Now, Kirkpatrick spent months and months on the ground, spoke to endless numbers of Libyans and American diplomatic and intelligence personnel, has interviews and documents, and the others who have responded and entirely dismissed his reporting seem to have nothing but faith in their view of things. Have we gone down some rabbit hole into a post-fact universe?
I hope not, because as a journalist, then that means my line of work is something more like interpretive dance. what's happening is you have news outlets like Fox News that have close relationships with the Republican side of things. You have news outlets like MSNBC that have close relationships with the Democratic Party and the liberal side of things. And their job is not necessarily just to simply report out the facts. Their job is to cheer for their team and to pull out facts that support their team's side of the argument. The Times' intention in this case was clearly to try to settle the argument in a neutral way. I've met David Kirkpatrick. He's not a partisan gunslinger by any stretch of the imagination. The idea that he's colluding with the Hillary campaign to make this story go away is silly. He's the Middle East bureau chief. He cares about what's happening on the ground. But the loudest voices, the ones on the left and the right, are the ones who are going to interpret things in ways that cheer or detract from their side. We can't let those people have a veto over solid, nonpartisan, straight down the middle reporting.
One of the other items on your list of why this will never go away is the problem of proving a negative.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's this famous Carl Sagan quote, "Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence." That was a line used by Donald Rumsfeld, of all people, to make the case that there still might be WMD in Iraq. But the point is, they weren't able to find any evidence of al-Qaeda involvement. Does that mean that there was no al-Qaeda involvement? How do you prove something didn't happen? You could take this too far and say, you know, what if space aliens did Benghazi? Well, you can't prove that they didn't. That's exactly why we're still having this debate, and I think we're still going to be having this debate well into 2016, whether we like it or not.
I think ISIS committee has subpoenaed E.T., but he's fighting the subpoena based on alien privilege. Blake, Happy New Year. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Blake Hounshell is deputy editor of Politico. Coming up, how to make money in journalism? Pass on lies. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. With the emergence of such sites as BuzzFeed, Upworthy, and Viral Nova, in 2013, news item virality advanced from art to science. Business models are constructed on the sharing of stories irresistible for the hilarity or inspiration or shock or outrage they engender. Truth, however, turns out to be optional. The year was chock full of false, from the Reddit misidentification of Boston bombing suspects to the scoop about Sarah Palin taking a job at Al Jazeera. That one was an internet joke passed on with no due diligence by the Washington Post. Then there was the epic Twitter feud, apparently between comedian Kyle Kinane and the Pace Salsa Company, a media-fueled tale of horrendous customer relations management and fired employees that transfixed the internet. That same internet is self-correcting. The facts in every case were sorted out, but not before a lot of online journalists passed on a lot of bad information, not only without checking it, but with an absolute incentive not to check it. Luke O'Neill is a freelance blogger and journalist who confronted the baloney economy in an Esquire.com piece titled, "The Year We Broke the Internet, An Explanation, An Apology, A Plea."
What it really is a model that values clicks over anything else, page views, eyeballs. They just want to get you to look at the post, whether or not there's any sort of information whatsoever that you actually want to know.
And they want those clicks because a click equals cash.
Right. In the media model we have now, for every unique visitor, for every click, that's the way you monetize those with advertisements.
All right. Understood. But if you look at the categories that sites like BuzzFeed have identified as the most clickable, you see funny, inspiring, cute, infuriating, and so on, more or less the same list that, let's say, print tabloids have used forever to amuse their readers. So what's different now?
The difference is that this model has infected what you might call the more serious news media. Traditional publications have had their struggles trying to figure out the internet, And now we're seeing sites like BuzzFeed and Upworthy who have sort of cracked the code. And the sad fact is that the things that get shared the most tend to be things that are rather frivolous, and oftentimes many of them don't even end up being true. But that doesn't even really seem to matter anymore.
All right, dude, you are not merely a dismayed observer here. Your article in Esquire.com was also a confession. You yourself admit to greedily passing along whatever item you think will be shareworthy without doing much fact-checking or any fact-checking at all.
My hands are certainly not completely clean in this matter. There was a story a couple weeks ago about Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac trailer being shown before a showing of Disney's Frozen to a theater of children. And I thought, well, this is going to be a hit.
Great story. Too good to check.
Exactly. I didn't call the movie theater to double check if it actually happened. I haven't done anything that I know to be false, but there have been a few things that are too good to check.
So what you're describing, Luke, is the quintessential perfect storm. The writers need to post a crazy lot just to make a living. The publications need to generate clicks. That's where its revenue comes from. You throw in plain journalistic laziness and human nature, an undiscriminating audience that just wants to be titillated or whatever. The convergence of these elements, clearly, if your story is right, overwhelms any commitment to truth.
I think that's exactly what happens. And as someone who's written for newspapers for many years, I know that if you make a small mistake in a printed newspaper like the Boston Globe, where I've contributed for a long time, they are not happy about that, even if it's something that doesn't matter. And I think that these big viral sites, they don't have that sort of standards in place. Like, consider the headline style that has become so prevalent this year. Like, this one cat that will restore your faith in humanity, or, you know, these 10 ice cream cones that'll make you want to believe in God. It's all based on hyperbole and exaggeration. The entire interaction is starting off on a falsehood.
Now, whether a salsa feud is real isn't exactly a high-stakes proposition. But looking at that environment, you kind of extrapolate, and you see a real catastrophe on the horizon.
These stories, they're sort of body blows to our skepticism immune system. And eventually, we're going to lose our ability to tell what's real or not, and it's going to have some real-world consequences. For example, there was a recent story about the elementary school in California that was getting flooded with threats because of a satirical news story about a child being suspended for saying Merry Christmas to an atheist teacher. That's one example of the ways this sort of model can have real-world consequences. People see something online, and they get fired up about it because it was designed to make you fired up so you would share it. Something like that, one of these days, is going to actually spill over into real-world violence.
In your piece, I think you kind of buried the lead. About halfway through, there is the following passage. I'm quoting you. "This is not a glitch in the system. It is the system. Readers are gullible, the media is feckless, garbage is circulated around, and everyone goes to bed happy and fed." You know, putting aside the future of BuzzFeed for a second, what does this tell us about the future of arm's-length journalism?
That's obviously clearly the biggest problem, because we're literally rewarded for sharing things that people want to read, which I think is the opposite of the job of a journalist. I think a journalist's job is to write about things that people don't want to read or that someone doesn't want you to read. Everything else, as the old saying goes, is just advertising. Instead of telling a story that needs to be told, we're thinking about how to tell something that people are going to want to read and going to want to share. What's worse is that every time we do it successfully, a lot of people who produce content like this, they're rewarded with page views bonuses. And so it encourages the young media producer to seek out things that are going to go viral as opposed to things that are true or need to be told.
Let me ask you one more thing before I jump out the window. Can I take any heart in the fact that your piece bemoaning big viral went viral big? Does that offer any hope? Please say yes. Please.
It does seem to have gone viral, but it's still a small drop in the bucket compared to how many people are going to share one of these stupid viral stories. I think it is heartening that it struck such a chord with so many members of the media. It seems like it's really something that everyone seems to be able to agree is a problem. I don't know necessarily what the solution is. Maybe wait 5 minutes before you press publish. Even something as small as that seems like it could have a positive effect.
All right, Luke. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Luke O'Neill is a freelance journalist and blogger who contributes to the Boston Globe, Esquire, Slate, and many others. And most of it is probably true. Given the elusiveness of journalistic profitability in the digital age and the click economy's inherent corruptibility, we were struck by a recent invitation letter from Columbia Journalism School Dean Steve Kahl to prospective students for a December informational event. The letter began, quote, "This is a great time to enter journalism." Is it now? Experienced journalists are out on the street. Fresh young ones are working for coolie wages or no wages at all. Nobody has devised a business model, online or off, to suggest that journalism will provide most Columbia graduates with a stable livelihood. And, as we've just seen, financial incentives often militate against journalistic truth. Therefore, to quote the philosopher, what up with that? Steve Kahl, welcome to On the Media.
Glad to be back, Bob.
A great time to enter journalism?
Well, your description of what's going on in the business is just wrong, I think, in many important ways. Bezos bought the Washington Post for $250 million. Pierre Omidyar is putting $250 million into a new investigative reporting venture. I think there's no question that we're in a boom, actually, for media. I think it's a fairer question to say, well, what does that mean for reporting? This is not like entering the civil service anymore, as it was when I entered the Washington Post at 25, stayed for 20 years, and my whole peer group were, by and large, people who stayed at newspaper institutions for many years at a time. This is a much more entrepreneurial period, and that means the skills that you need and the kind of temperament that you need to really live this fantastic life, you're going to have to be quicker on your feet.
You yourself said that many of the opportunities that are out there for journalists are funded by investors, entrepreneurs, various kinds of seed capital. In the good old days, journalism jobs were funded by the ongoing profits of large media organizations, which gets back to the premise of this conversation. I don't really see any evidence that you're, at least in this one invitation to one event, managing the expectations of incoming students.
I think that journalism is about a life. It's fun to ask impertinent questions at press conferences, to be standing on a balcony in the middle of a revolution, to have a voice, to be able to learn how to write for audiences, to think every morning about what matters and what doesn't. It is a great time to have that life because media is at the center of our society. It's at the center of our government. It's at the center of our powerful private institutions. We all walk around with media tools in our hands, consuming media all day long. Who wouldn't want to be involved in that? And your definition of what journalism is, like mine, is rooted in an era that's gone, a civil service era. It was an accident of business history. It was an accident of social history. But the life of journalism is still there.
I have no argument with you that the business model for journalism is changing. The post-mass media age business model for journalism has not emerged. And further stipulate that there are all sorts of benefits to a Columbia Graduate School of Journalism education. That's not at issue. What is at issue is the role of the journalism school to make sure that those who wish to enter it understand exactly what it is they're entering. Are you comfortable that your new class of graduate students will enter with eyes wide open about the realities of the marketplace?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I think not because they're going to take what I write them in an invitation to an information session as the answer to that question, but because they are college graduates who have been living in the world. They're curious people considering graduate schools of journalism. At that point, you have to have a fairly serious lean toward a life in journalism, and it is like other graduate degrees, a point of entry.
I got to ask you this, Steve. When you were considering taking this position, dean of the Columbia Journalism School, did you think about whether to take that job is to sort of breed white rats only to kill them in the laboratory? Did you have any kind of misgivings or concerns about the ultimate role of journalism schools under the current economic conditions?
I didn't. I mean, maybe this is a flaw in my character, but I actually believe in journalism so profoundly, and that I actually think counterintuitively that with the big, confident, incumbent institutions that I grew up in and around, the Washington Post and its peers, the big magazine publishing companies, with all of them disrupted, laying people off, losing confidence, that actually a durable institution like a university becomes relatively more important because somebody has to interrogate all of this technological change for its value to readers, audiences, and citizens. Somebody has to ask, why do our new abilities to share cat videos matter? To also teach the kinds of skills in data science, computational science, that will allow the graduates who do come through to prove that journalism still matters and to get paid for it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Bob.
Steve Kahl is the Henry Luce Professor of Journalism at Columbia Journalism School, where he is also the dean. Coming up, gone for the week, but not forgotten, Brooks' memorable conversation with Cyndi Lauper. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The 2013 was an amazing year for Cyndi Lauper's Broadway musical, Kinky Boots. The show was nominated in 13 categories at the Tony Awards, winning Best Musical and Best Score. And in December, Lauper received her 15th Grammy nomination for Musical Theater Album. Earlier this year, Brooke recorded a live interview with Lauper. I'll let Brooke take up the story from here.
The musical's based on the 2005 British movie about a real-life struggling shoe factory that finds new life in producing quality boots for transvestites, which makes perfect sense as a subject for Lauper, not just because of her advocacy of LGBT issues, but because it hits yet again the guiding theme of her life, as recounted in her new memoir and her work since her emergence as a pop artist in the 80s. Be whoever you choose to be. A simple message, tough to carry out, which she knows all too well. I had a long conversation with Cyndi Lauper before a live audience in the green space here at WNYC, and we started by playing the video of the song that introduced her to the world. The phone rings in the middle of the night, my boy.
Are they watching it too?
The people listening to the webcast are watching it and can watch it in perpetuity. But you didn't really want to sing that song, did you?
Not in the beginning. Because, you know, it was written by a guy. And, of course, a guy's not going to sing about what I'd want to sing about. There's a guy. Could you imagine? So, you know, when he said, you know, Father dear, we are the fortunate ones, you know, my little rebel heart took issue with it.
We have a little snippet of Robert Hazard's Bowie-esque original.
There is something cool about this that nobody else ever heard. Rick Chertoff collected these songs and was looking for a singer. He didn't know he was going to get me. You know, it's like a dress. You go to the department store, you try on a dress. Let me tell you, not every dress fits good on you. Same with a song. You put a song on, you have to know the story that you are telling. You have to come from a place where you own the story because you know it. And when you connect to it and you tell the truth, you will resonate the truth to a listener. And when it came to girls, I couldn't get girls to sit right. Rick said to me, listen, he said, think of what it could mean if you sang it. And I thought about it.
You wrote that you had the faces of a lot of sad women in your head when you were reconstructing that song. And it's not by accident that your mom was in the video. She was caught in the kind of trap that you didn't want to be in.
It wasn't just me. If you look at all the women of that time, or even women now who still struggle all over the world, you don't always get the fair shake that everybody thinks you get. In fact, you get a half a handshake, basically. And I just felt like when he said, think of what it could mean, I saw my grandmother, I saw my aunt, and I saw my mother. These were women that were disenfranchised. You got to understand, my family came from Sicily. In Sicily, they don't look at women like an opportunity for a life. They look at women as two opportunities. You marry a morph to somebody wealthy, or they stay home as free domestic help. You know, they don't go out and get educated. They weren't allowed to write, you know, stories. So I did it. And when I did it, I made sure I got as many multiracial girls as I could in the lineup so that no matter where it played in the world or the country, any little girl of any color could look at themselves and see themselves and know that they too should have a joyful existence and are, you know, entitled. And we did it under the guise of fun while we were all laughing and I was the big idiot. The big thing was, everybody, every woman is entitled, not just some. So I felt proud that we were able to get by the gatekeepers, you know?
You left Ozone Park at 17. You
yes.
stuffed a change of underwear, an apple, and a book in a paper bag.
Yes, and a book called Grapefruit.
So by Yoko Ono.
Yes, it changed my life. The Beatles, Joni Mitchell, The Rolling Stones, Sly and the Family Stone, all those wonderful songs that helped me exist. And my mother's beautiful books, you know, she always had the Rubaiyats of Omar Khayyam. You know, she took us to see Shakespeare at the Delacorte Theater. She never took us to see Broadway. She thought it was too expensive. But I learned all her records because that's what I sang. At 4 years old, I played The King and I every day. Every day, so much so that and I knew every word and every breath and every character. My grandmother came from upstairs. She walked downstairs, opened the door, took the record off of the little red record player, went back upstairs with it without saying a word. And then when Funny Girl happened, she gave up.
I know that you were hitchhiking around. You had to train yourself how not to be hungry. You had some bad experiences.
Yeah, but I did not want to have success on somebody else's terms. Everything I wanted to do, I wanted to own it. I wanted it to be mine.
You wrote in your book that from the very start, you were hell-bent on mixing art and music, the visual and the sound and the story. I wanted to be larger than life, to look completely different. I wanted to be a painting.
I am still a painting. They painted me for hours.
Do you feel a kinship at all with Lady Gaga?
Well, I think that she grew up watching me and Madonna and Annie Lennox and Boy George, and I think all of it influenced her, and also she was an art major.
Madonna emerged just a little bit after you, and her record company and the media tried to cook up some kind of rivalry.
Well, you know, it's always that way with women. They always have to pit one against the other. You know, not very imaginative, is it? And I didn't like to be pit against another woman. I couldn't do that. And I just felt kind of lost because I thought they appreciated my art. And all of a sudden, it was this contest. And I just felt like, you know, I want to make great music. And I want to kick some butt. And she was a wonderful businesswoman who never, I don't know that she really got into fights with anyone. She was much smarter, where I lost my allies and I said like all the wrong things to the right people. And I never explained how I felt. I would find myself in situations and be like, yeah, well, you know, F you. I can't say that, can I? It's public radio.
We can bleep it.
Well, I just said F.
Oh, that you can totally say.
All right, so...
But we'll bleep it anyway, just so it sounds more authentic.
Well, you know, like the first record company I went to, I mean, that's why it probably took so long. I was signed by this German company. They said to me, we're going to make you into the next Streisand. And I looked at them, I said, what do I want to do that for? I said, what kind of lobotomy do I need? I said, listen, why don't you find somebody else and do that? And I think everybody at the table choked because he happened to be the president. But you know what? If you can't be honest, why do you want to live a life where, and why would you suffer so long to finally get to a place where you couldn't tell the truth and be yourself? In the arts and in music, you know, everybody said, well, what happened to music? Yeah, what happened to music? It became full of shit. It became not truthful. In the 80s, all those crazy outfits and hairdos, yeah, they were rough and wild and weird. But it originated with the people who were singing and performing. It originated with the performers. And there's some idiot come in and say, well, I don't think you should do that. You know, somebody told me, they said, oh, I think your makeup, it shouldn't be like that. And I'm thinking to myself, that's right. Biatch, soon as you're at it. And then it just, from then on, it became war paint. That's what turned me around. You know, 1989, they used to say to me, well, what the hell is that you're wearing? Why can't you wear jeans and a t-shirt like Katrina and the Waves? I'd be like... Oh, my God.
You weren't walking on sunshine?
I wanted to take some sunshine. You know, the problem was that they also threatened you because George Michaels, when he tried to get out of the contract, they sued him and said they were going to tie up his career and look how his career is ruined. You will be ruined. They always threatened me with ruination. And after a while, when I was ruined, I figured, hey, I could do whatever the hell I want now because, you know, once you're on the bottom, what are they going to do? Put another nail in the coffin? Obviously, it didn't work, did it? Because I keep coming back, so what the hell?
What always struck me about your singing, the whole honest thing that you do, is its fearlessness and its generosity. And I found this 1985 clip of you with Patti LaBelle.
Flashback, warm nights. Almost left behind, suitcase of memories, time at
all. Oh, sometimes you picture me, I'm falling to our head. You're calling to me, I can't hear a word you said that you said.
I wish I could play the whole thing. It's pretty.
Truthfully, when I heard her sing Time After Time, I cried. Inside, I felt like, well, it's one of the greatest voices ever. And she's singing one of my songs. And I was always told, you know, I had to fight so hard to get my own songs on my own record because I was told that I wasn't a good enough writer. And I was always told most of my life that a woman with a big voice sings, not writes. And then Mariah Carey came along and she gave him 1-4. Good for her.
After that, obviously it was smooth sailing, except for the bankruptcy and losing your voice. And
my path was never like anybody else's, even after I freaking became famous, when I thought, okay, now it's Easy Street. the easy street I have not found, except for when Harvey Fierstein called me up, and I just finished a punishment tour, which I thought, oh, do a rough ride and go to Europe, doesn't matter, get on a smelly, stinky bus, you know, sweat, be grungy. I don't like dirt. So when Harvey called me and he said, do you want to write for me? This was Harvey Fierstein, who is a great storyteller. I admire him so much. And he called me and asked me if I wanted to write for him. Of course I said yes. It's been an unbelievable experience for me. And I chased over the whole world. And I felt like Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. You know, the lion, the tin man, and the scarecrow. I had all three of them walking me through. Steve Aremus, Jerry Mitchell, and Harvey Fierstein. You know who's who. And I realized at the end, after I chased the whole world, what I should have just looked at was my own backyard, because Broadway is a very comfortable place for me.
Kinky Boots. It's based on the British film about an old school shoe company passed down three generations. It's going under. The son can either fire the employees he grew up with or reinvent the company. What they have to do is find a niche market.
And he happens to bump into Lola, a drag queen, being attacked. And she had pulled off her shoe and said, I can handle the likes of these guys, and knocks them out with a shoe. And then he told her later on, oh, I could fix this, cheaply made. And she said, no, expensive shoes, cheaply made, Lola said. So he went back, and he was still struggling, and all of a sudden he realized the niche market was sitting right in front of him on the chair. He could make a kinky boot, you know, or a boot. He didn't know how kinky yet. You know, it's a development thing,
yeah,
for him.
Yeah, that goes on. Now let's play
Step
the revelation.
One.
Step one.
Are they going to see this?
Yes.
On the radio?
No.
Time for a shake up. Look at me, wake up. Taking control. This is a new beginning. My gears are spinning. Let's rock and roll. Just put one foot onward and forward. Used to be a zero, but now I clearly feel. That I may be the hero who reinvents the heel. I may be facing the impossible. I may be chasing after miracles. And there may be the steepest mountain to overcome. But this is step one. Yeah, this is step one.
A member of the audience asked, what were her sources of inspiration over the years?
Doesn't matter. You know, it comes from someplace, excellent. Who cares? You know, just be open to anything. Because when you're creating, it feels bigger than yourself. And it's better to be involved with things that are bigger than yourself sometimes. And also, you have to always, always remember. And I'm me too. I'm like a bully. I have to remember kindness and generosity. And with that, things come. Knit, for goodness sakes, if it makes you feel good. Do creative things. It feeds the other side of your brain. You know, do any kind of music. Play a freaking instrument. It's joyful. It's joyful. It makes you feel better. I play a dulcimer because them open fifths when you strum it, it's so soothing, you know? It's just soothing. And, you know, that's scientific, because there's a doctor that worked in maybe Creedmoor. No, not Creedmoor, Bellevue. And he worked with tuning forks. I got them tuning forks. And they have the open fifths, very soothing. So I thought, oh, it's scientific.
Perfect. My conversation with Cyndi Lauper lasted more than an hour. What you just heard is a heavily edited construction based on a wide-ranging journey through her mind and heart, with stops in the recording studio, various churches, grunge fashion, the music industry, reality TV, her mother's womb, the White House, and much, much more. Plus video. To take it all in, go to onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Dirkman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Kimmy Regler. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield. Happy New Year.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.